was also not necessarily contradictory or in opposition, but in a different sort of way.
So, but we start, we're not starting from chapter one.
No, we're doing chapter two, chapter three, and then chapter, I think it's
four.
Six or five. Well, it's the overland.
Okay.
Chapter five. So we're doing two, three, and five. We might, you know, I mean, I encourage you to look at the rest of the book, but we'll do two this week, three next week, and then we'll look at five after Easter, and then we'll spend some time getting that sort of idea of the thematic structure so that we can, so you've got the outline. Basically, I will have essay questions in mind, and I'll structure a class for a long sort of being able to work out the essay questions. Yeah, two, three, and five in the chapter.
So it's just lecture.
So we're going to have three sort of sessions, seminar sessions, and then the last three sessions before then will be like vision sessions. But the idea will be we'll focus on, in each week we'll focus on sort of having a question of how would we answer this?
You know, explicitly you're going to present us.
I won't give you explicitly the question, because obviously that's not quite allowed, even though I think that's ridiculous that it's not. But I won't explicitly give you the question, but you'll pretty much, if you've got half a brain, you're going to work out the question. The question will be phrased in such a way not to trip you up. It will be just a sort of, you know, one of those, you should be able to sort of make revision notes from those last three classes. Which, you know, if you then take the revision notes and you combine them with your own notes and you do a little bit of sort of, you know, reading through and clarifying, you should have more than enough sort of 6 points, 7 points to take into the exam so that you can, you know, outline in your question sort of 6 or 7 points that would give an opportunity to have space to discuss briefly, because you're very familiar with what's going on.
So is it so one question, 2 hours exam? 2 hours exam?
One question, 2 hours exam, yeah. It would be a sort of straightforward write an essay, so you will need to be able to sort of show half a dozen points of the account. Let's say it's the account of active, reactive forces or something like that. So you'll need to be half a dozen points of that. And then you'll need to sort of have, there'll be a question that leads you into sort of what's interesting, what, you know, something to discuss about that. And that's what we'll sort of focus on the last 3 weeks. Giving you bits, you know, and I'll probably bring along handouts then as well, so that you go like this, so you sort of literally can just, I mean, I've no desire to try and fail people in exams. I just think exams are a matter of trying to show that you're familiar enough with the material so that you're, you know, in a sense, you've competently learned something. That's all. I'm not trying to get you to be fantastically original in an exam. You just need to show that you're familiar enough with the material. So if you've learned how it works, you know, we're not talking about being experts here. We're talking about sort of being familiar with the material so that you know that it's not just a matter of like denying reality or saying there's no such thing as truth, or, you know, post-structuralists just think, you know, everything's just a story, or, you know, sort of rather pathetic responses we get from popular culture. let's focus on this idea that when he talks about the notion that consciousness is always reactive, we're not identifying consciousness from thought. Okay, so thought is always, in a sense, something that's unexpressed. This is much more explicit in Kozlowski. In a sense, something that's unexpressed. And in a sense, what they're trying to do is they're trying to encounter the active force in consciousness. Now, if consciousness is always reactive, the only active force that we're really going to be looking at is that which we would call thought. You know, that which prompts, as it were, consciousness. So there's always going to be a tension between how you express something, what words you use, what propositions you write down, and the thought that's prompting or pushing those words you're writing down. And it's the thought, that force, that we're trying to constantly retrieve, constantly trying to allow it to be active, allow it to sort of come to the fore again. And one of the ways in which we find that thought comes to the fore is by making us trouble, disturb, precisely by encountering the difference and the tension between the way we write something down, the way we explicitly phrase our knowledge, and that which we are thinking. That tension is one of the ways in which we encounter this sort of active force. And by trying to, in a sense, bring to the fore the tension, by trying to show the tension rather than say it, by trying to show that tension, we begin to allow the active force to be expressed. Even though, strictly speaking, it can't fully be expressed in the written word, we begin to allow it to be expressed by being shown. Okay, so if we show a paradoxical situation, what we don't say is in the paradox there is nonsense. We don't say it makes no sense. We don't say there is no thought behind the paradox. What we precisely encounter in the paradox is a thought that encounters its own limits in expression. There's some problem that we want to bring to the fore here. Now, we've got two options there. We can just do this as a sort of, you know, pleasant game. We can just constantly try and fuck people up, show how what they think they know is not what they know. It's a fairly common strategy of philosophers, of course. And you should all be relatively competent doing this by now, you know, in a sort of, even a small scale way with your friends or your family. If you want to piss them off, you know, you can sort of show them how what they think they know is not what they really know, and you can just sort of push them to contradictions in a good Socratic way. It's been the root of philosophy ever since Socrates. You know, you think you know what virtue is, well, let's try and identify it. Well, in fact, as soon as you try and name it, you find that that's not virtue, this isn't virtue, the other thing's not virtue. But you still want to hang on to the idea that there is something like virtue. Obviously, Plato then goes, well, of course you can hang on to it because you've got faults. But that's not what Socrates is doing. He's trying to prompt your tension, prompt you to encounter the tension between what it is you're trying to think and the words which you are using to think it. So the same thing, really, is at the core of Nietzsche, according to Klosowski and Deleuze. It's very, very much to the fore in Deleuze. Very, very much to the fore. This is, in a sense, one of Deleuze's absolutely central themes at this time in his writing. It's central to this book and it's central to Difference and Repetition as well. So in section 5 we encounter one of the ways in which this is sort of played out, as it were, this way of sort of showing a problem. And played out in terms of the eternal return. Now, what the core of this argument is trying to do is encounter, as it were, what we call this account, let's say, is trying to do, is encounter the thought of time. And in doing so, allow us to think what it is becoming. Okay, now one of the crucial words, one of the crucial lines is on page 44 in this section. Paragraph at the bottom there. How does the thought of pure becoming serve as a foundation for the eternal return? All we need to do is think this thought. All we need to do to think this thought is to stop believing in being as distinct from and opposed to becoming, or to believe in the being of becoming itself. Now that particular phrase there is absolutely crucial. We're not going to have an argument that persuades or convinces or, you know, gives us, as it were, a conclusion that becoming is, you know, everything, that there is no being, or, you know, that somehow, you know, we can prove that everything is becoming. All we need to do to think this thought, the thought of pure becoming, is to stop believing in being as distinct from and opposed to becoming. So what it's trying to do in this process, this is one of the things to remember with the Nietzsche, Deleuze, Klosowski, is this relationship to the way in which we consciously express things, the way in which we write things down and make arguments, is often, they think, a relationship to our beliefs. And they want to alter or free up what we believe. We believe, they think, certain things to be true, to be facts, and their strategy is to constantly try and, as it were, distinguish that which we think we believe from that which we're trying to think. Okay, and so they're going to push us back to the thought and let us give up our beliefs. And obviously, all we need to do to think this thought is stop believing. Well, obviously, it looks like they're saying something like, just stop it, you know. Just stop believing that, you're silly people. Stop believing that being and becoming is the same thing, you know. Being and becoming are distinct, rather. The process by which you stop believing is by engaging in the texts and the work that they're trying to do. That's what they're trying to present you with, a way in which you can stop believing. So don't be too sort of literal there. They're not just sort of calling upon you to stop believing, full stop, for no reason. They're trying to give you a ground to stop believing rather than a reason to stop believing. And the ground is going to be the way in which they deal with the issue. So the problem of becoming is posed in this rather sort of straightforward way. In terms of this idea of an initial state and a terminal state. They argue that, well, Deleuze argues that Nietzsche thinks, Deleuze argues that Nietzsche thinks that in the traditional reading of the eternal return and cosmology, the initial state and the terminal state are taken to be the same, to be equal, to be identical in that sense. And that this problem, this is a sort of way in which you produce a sort of eternal return as a circle. You produce it as literally, you return in a circle all the way through. And we sort of encountered this a little bit when we were dealing with Klosowski. We sort of used it a bit as a pedagogical device. You know, we were sort of enabling ourselves to think that. But one of the things that we need to begin to sort of develop from that is the idea that at the core of Nietzsche and Deleuze and Klosowski, most importantly, at the core of this idea of the will to power, is somehow the thought of the eternal return, but not as a circle. It doesn't literally return. It doesn't literally turn around on itself and just repeat an identity. And the reason that they want to sort of push against that is quite simply a sort of paradox. They are saying something like, given a situation of infinite time, if the initial state and the terminal state just had to be, as it were, matched, this would already have happened. You know, this would sort of just must have already occurred. Couldn't have been something, as it were, that we were in the middle of. So they, you know, from nothing, from a zero point state, all the way up through all the various different variations in being, back down again to the zero point state. Now that's the traditional notion of the eternal return. So it gets to the original zero point state, which obviously the end is the beginning. This original zero point state obviously had within it all the other developments. We just start off again on the same road and we come back to the same point, and then we just start off again on the same road and come back to the same point. All of that is presupposing that this initial state and this terminal state are identical. The end is the beginning. The problem, they think, is that this presupposes being, an identity. An identity of equality, that the terminal state and the initial state are identical. Now, one of the things that they want to suggest is that there is a very simple proposition that's implicit in the concept of becoming, which is that it can have had no initial state. Becoming and the eternal return as the principle or the law or the way in which becoming operates, the being of becoming, as they want to call it. But the eternal return, becoming, can have no initial state. It never began. It is always been there. Okay, now that's the paradoxical and peculiar thought. Now, there's a relatively, we can try it now, you know, we've got the sort of presentation there, so you need to sort of sit back and start asking yourself a series of questions. Right. Why did time start? We can ask, why did the universe begin, or why did being begin, or why did becoming begin to become? Why is there a presupposition, as it were, in our consciousness or in our way of dealing with the world that we need a beginning point? What is actually going on there? Is this an assumption that just must be the case?
Is it related to how our kind of false conception of consciousness arises, perhaps? Like, I mean, if we develop this kind of deluded sense of consciousness as something with the self and identity, then that could, create this notion of a beginning, because we posit when we first, we created consciousness. Consciousness arose, we think naturally as something that came to being, but actually arose as something which we got trained into thinking. And because we created that and it had a beginning, we impose and we place consciousness as having a superiority over other aspects of being. Then we do the same with the other thing you're talking about.
I think there's something similar to that, there's something similar to that going on now. Let's just try and focus on this idea of why do we think things have a beginning? Why is it assumed? Why does that make... It's a compelling thought. It's difficult to conceive of what time is without encountering this issue of when does it begin. It's difficult to conceive of being, whether you think of it in terms of the material universe or cosmology or whatever, without thinking, well, it has a beginning. But of course, how does that make sense?
Is it like easier to understand? Like when you start from naught, you always start from what you don't. You can't start from eternity. That just goes on. Would it be something like that?
I think that's very much sort of in the idea of what's going on. So, if we encounter something that, you know, in a sense exceeds us, one of the difficulties we have with it is, of course, knowing how we can work with it, how we can do something with it, you know, how we can fit it into the rest of the universe, where we start, where we stop.
We need that. Sorry, we need that determinacy to make it more digestible to us, more applicable.
Yeah, I think so. To a certain extent, I think that's one. I think that's the sort of the way in which they would be inclined to suggest that's why we sort of solidify things into sort of fixed identities, into this idea of becomings. But let's just pursue the idea that the argument sort of has some sort of force underneath it. Were they saying something like, if becoming had a starting point, if the eternal return had an initial point, and this initial point was the same as the end point, it would already have happened. So that's a peculiar thought.
Well, if it already happened, it could have been the cause of the snapping in the mind which made us forget that it happened in the first place.
But in a sense, nothing would exist any longer, is what they're suggesting.
Well, nothing does exist in the same way that it would have existed before it occurred. And we've forgotten it, therefore we don't know it happened, and therefore we've forgotten it existed in a certain way, and now we become...
Right, okay, so in what's this space, what sort of place are we now existing in?
Conscious, rather than pre-conscious.
But when does that end?
That ends in death.
Right, so you've got a terminal state. So becoming is a sort of terminal state, a death point, and a birth point. So why has it not already died? Why are you not already dead?
Because now we're just purely organic.
Which means, it has some sort of, must have a start point, must have an end point, you're somehow in the middle. Isn't it lucky that you're somehow always in the middle of the way in which time is going on, the universe has not already ended?
I'm sort of finding a problem with the notion of direction. Look at the time, it's kind of linear thing, we have this point and then it moves into this point. It's a constant moving into a point, that kind of direction, but then it doesn't work with notion. You know, how does it come back again? You know, if it sort of seems to be moving in a straight line, you know, this followed by this followed by this, you know, that doesn't explain the kind of curvature or anything.
You mean like the Einsteinian curvature of space or something along those sort of lines?
Maybe, I'm not sure.
Don't you have to extricate yourself from that situation in order to be able to judge it in that way, in a sort of spatial way where you have a beginning and end? Don't you have to stand outside in a transcendent sense, such that when you go back into it, then there is no time anymore?
Right.
Because you become a part of it.
This is far closer to the idea. It's a sense in which if we begin to impose, you know, a measurement structure such that we can measure the start of the universe, we can measure the end of it, and this is what physicists are now telling us, you know, it started 12 billion years ago and it ends in 5 billion years, you know, the universe has a 17 billion year lifespan. And you think, well, you know, I mean, everyone incurs this, a physicist occurs, what goes before the Big Bang then? What goes on then? Does this just pop out of nowhere? Yes, that's what they say, it pops out of nowhere. Just ex nihilo arises. And of course, you think, well, that sort of doesn't make any sense. It doesn't really sort of... This seems peculiar. It seems as though it's a sort of entirely random moment that has to be put into the system. Of course, it is a random moment that has to be put in the system, in the same way that the meter stick in Paris is, in a sense, a random moment that has to be put into a system, so that we can measure it and quantify it, and in doing so, feel like we've identified it, grasped it, know it, it's fixed, it's there, that's the way it is, it's a fact. We can now deal with the fact, and it's just... It's lucky that we seem to be living in a moment in time in which we're capable of measuring the beginning point and end point of this universe, and it's not dead already. Aren't we lucky? Aren't we fantastically lucky? And of course, it's sort of only lucky from the outside. What they're trying to suggest is something much more simple in a sense, is that, in fact, none of this has any relevance inside time. None of this has any real relevance imminent to the way in which being operates, which is not with a start point and with an end point, but being is just a process of becoming. It's a process of what we would call temporalization, if you like, in terms of time, rather than temporality. So in a sense, time is made as it goes along. If we didn't have people that registered time or temporal differences, or we had creatures that measured temporal differences or organisms that measured temporal differences on a completely different scale, of course, you know, for the sun, we might want to say, well, how long is the solar system? How long is the, you know, what's the length of time of the solar system for the sun? Well, what measure of criteria does the sun have for the length of time of the solar system? Is it not just a blink of an eye? Why couldn't it be just a blink of an eye? Why is it not saying that something pops into existence and pops out of existence again? We have to remember that the time in which we sort of place beginning points and end points, in which we quantify and measure, is an anthropocentric time. An anthropocentric time is essentially means a time out of time. It's transcendent to, it's standing aside from, and assuming that we have the only position from which we can judge when the universe began, when the universe ends, and in a sense the duration, as Bergson called it, the duration of these things. And so that duration, that temporality is fixed in a single location point, defined only in terms of the human, only in terms of the anthropocentric. Now that's not to say, in a way, and no one here is denying, that the cosmologists are probably right and the Big Bang happened 12 billion years ago and the universe as we know it will collapse in on itself or go to cold death or whatever a particular theory is at the moment, in about 5 or 6 billion years. No one's denying any of those facts as physics understands them and wants to present them. What's being denied is, in any sense, that equals time, or that equals being. Okay, that is what's being denied. Those, they think, are not equivalent to the nature of being, or the nature of becoming, or the nature of time. They are simply a measurement according to a particular criteria is entirely human and anthropocentric. And in that sense, is no more true than the measurement or the sense of duration that the sun has, or that the fly has, or that the moon has. These things, in a sense, would be said to also have their own durations, their own becomings. And as an ontology, we're not interested in an ontology that's only relevant to the human. That is just something that makes no sense for these philosophers because it, in a sense, assumes that the ontology has a goal or a purpose rather than has a truth. If the purpose is just to make us capable of knowing the universe a bit better, we'll go and do science. To be honest, you're not going to be able to know the universe better by doing philosophy. You're going to know the universe better by going and doing a bit of physics. Learn some physics and chemistry and you're going to have a much more practical relationship to the universe if you're doing philosophy. The idea here is to sort of try and encounter the thought that's meant to be going on behind this, and that's quite often this idea of a thought of truth, and show how different that thought is from the way in which it's going to be expressed, and then to try and clarify why it's expressed in that way for the physicists, why it's expressed in that way for the average person who thinks time has a certain beginning and a certain end. Why they need to express that, what's the use purpose, the value of this, is that need to express it in that way active or reactive? Is it something that's positive and life-affirming or something that's going to be negative and life-denying? Those are the type of questions they want to ask. They don't want to say it's wrong. They want to ask, why is it put in this way? What are the criteria that are established and are those criteria active or reactive? Are they, are they expressions of an attempt to encounter life or an attempt to sort of constrain and kill life, hold it into certain sort of limits? Borders.
We have to do a lot of work on the active and reactive then, to convince us of that fundamental foundation as a criterion for judgment of these things. So
it's not really a criteria for judgment. It's a criteria more for interpretation and assessment. Sorry. I think so. I mean, I don't. It would be very difficult to extract from these texts straightforward criteria for why say let's take the traditional argument of science. Straightforward criteria for why scientific facts are wrong. Don't think they could argue that. They would merely want to argue that scientific facts are not the only whole and complete truth.
They're not complete.
They are specifically organised to to express certain needs or certain criteria, and we can only understand them if we then look at those criteria, those needs. And, you know, those needs and those criteria, then we can assess the forces on. Do they, you know, why on earth does science need to delimit the sense of the beginning of the universe and the end of the universe? We might argue that it needs to do this in order to make its claims to truth so grand and all-encompassing that no one can deny them, and it, you know, presents itself as the absolute fount of all knowledge. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is it active or reactive? Well, we could say it's active because it wants to try and push forward a notion of truth, and we could say maybe it's reactive because it wants to deny other positions of truth. So you just have to try and find a way in which you want to encounter it and make an argument. Generally, I'd say the scientist who wants to claim absolute truth is going to be a reactive figure because they want to deny that any other truth is even viable or possible. There's only one form. That's to a sort of a certain sort of plurality that I think is useful or interesting or productive.
This sort of distance from your work, though, makes it very difficult to actually work. This distance from what you'll be from your argument. Say you have an argument that you want to bring forward to the table in terms of reactive and active. We'll say, look, okay, I accept your point, that may be the case, but there's also this point. It's very difficult for you not to argue for your point through antagonizing their point. So it's quite tough to get to your head around this sort of way of argument, this sort of way of philosophy. If you're not.
Well, I mean, in a sense, yes, you're right, but I mean, obviously, in all philosophy, the goal is not to present simple argument that it reaches a simple conclusion. And if we're going to do that, then we're going to, you know, if we just want nice, fixed, firm conclusions, there's a whole series of disciplines out there that present you with structures of doing this, you know, from music or, you know, musical form or whatever, all the way through to mathematics, in its more sort of strict sense. But, you know, the idea of this type of philosophy is to try and develop the skills by which we encounter problems and think them through. Now, whether that is of any particular use is another matter. Whether there's something positive to that is itself another matter. Obviously, these people will associate the capacity to sort of develop the thinking of a problem with the positive goal of philosophy. I mean, they tend to do that. But yes, there's a sense in which if you constantly distance yourself from your arguments, you not just end up playing certain games. I don't know. I don't think there's a terrible. I mean, one of the arguments that's presented against the post-structuralists is that all they do is disturb knowledge. They make people sceptical. It's one of these sort of, they're relativist and they're sceptics. And one needs to sort of suggest, well, you know, less so perhaps with relativism, but what exactly would be the problem of being a sceptic? Surely that's one of the core motivations of philosophical thought, is to be sceptical and to be competently sceptical or interestingly sceptical, not to just sort of be dogmatically sceptical on the basis of the knowledge arguments, you know, the inductive knowledge structures or something like that, which you can't make this claim because you can't prove it. And that's one way of being sceptical. You know, you can't prove it, therefore it's not knowledge, therefore you can't say it. Well, that's a sort of crude way. These sort of thoughts, these sort of ways of thinking are more sophisticated or complex versions, but I do think have a relationship, quite a strong relationship to scepticism. In terms of relativism, I think that's usually a bad charge to lay against post-structuralism. They don't argue for or take the position of a relativism, but what they do tend to do is suggest that there is a sort of inherent relativity in a large amount of our knowledge, but not all of it, not necessarily. But they do argue that it's inherently large amounts of it are tend to be relative. So the criteria, the structures, those type of things. Okay, page 40, let's try one of their sort of phrases, statements, see what we can do with that. This goes back to the idea that they're producing an ontology of unequal forces. There's a phrase there that's in italics. Quantity itself is therefore inseparable from a difference in quantity. Okay, so does that make any sense to people?
Was it something about equal forces would sort of cancel each other out? So, you know, if there was no sort of difference in quantities of forces, then there wouldn't be anything. It'd be just like a kind of flat line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I've got written in the margin, but I don't know.
Yes, to dream of two equal forces, even if they are said to be of opposite senses, is of course an approximate dream, is the cystical dream of the living as submerged, which chemistry dispels. Why does chemistry dispel it?
Chemistry has hierarchies of elements such that the stronger element will always displace the weaker element, and as such you can't have an element that's perfectly equal to another element. Therefore, there will always be interruption, there will always be sort of reaction going on if we come
back. Right, well, it's very, very much at the core of Nietzsche's idea, is that sort of, that there's this...
Just curious.
Right. And if you were to take the obverse, as it were, if everything was exactly equal, then essentially the idea is that nothing would then happen. It would be a single thing. It would just be one large molecule. Not only would there be, you know, no distinction between those molecules, those elements, but there'd also be no thought. It wouldn't be a conscious molecule. There'd be nothing that enabled, as it were, one moment, in inverted commas, to be different from another moment, so that a thought could go from one place to another or move at all. But even more straightforwardly, quantity. Let's say 100 grams. Does 100 grams make any sense if everything was 100 grams? The very concept of a quantity involves more than one. In order to have the concept of a quantity, there must be differences in quantity. There must be something that you can scale against, as it were. You can write a scale against. Otherwise, the very idea of a quantity makes no conceptual sense. So this is, in a sense, something very simple. Quantity itself is therefore inseparable from difference in quantity. 100 grams is 100 grams because it's not 99 grams. Not because it's 100 grams. Okay, this is absolutely crucial, and this is one of the ways in which structuralism first encountered the relationship of differences through Saussure, which we talked about very briefly in the first lecture, which is that the word, let's say, dog, is not meaningful because of the word dog. The word dog is meaningful because of the word God and the word bog and the word, you know, various others, because of its difference from other words. In itself, it has no meaning. Meaning derives from a structure of differences. So, in a sense, there's a sort of empty space at the core of a word, which is, in a sense, why we can have translations. Because, you know, what we're translating is not words, but spaces where things, differences, are sort of similarly structured, and why we sometimes can't translate, because the structure, if you like a network or a fishing net, if we had one fishing net and we put it on top of another one, a translation is matching up the crossover points between one fishing net and another. And all you've got to imagine is if we had changed the size of the mesh, some of the things will match up and other ones won't. And that's what language and meaning is taken to be for the structuralists. It's much more like a net, where each word is a crossover point, a linkage point to other words and other differences. And they're going to say the same about measurements and quantities, is each quantity is not something in itself, but is just a connection point between others. So we're in a system in which we have nets and meshes. And so one mesh, say the political social system or the economic theory, you know, can be matched against another mesh only insofar as the mesh is at the same grain. And each of these sort of different meshes is precisely different in a way because the grain is slightly different. Because the relationship of differences is slightly different. So, I mean, sort of, some of these things are relatively straightforward. You know, you just have, I mean, when you come across a sentence like quantity itself is therefore inseparable from difference in quantity, just try and sort of do the counterintuitive. If there was no difference in quantity, what would quantity be? when some of these statements, if that difference was removed, what would happen? What would they be left with? Let's just touch on a couple of last points. We've touched on one of them, that notion of cosmic subjectivity. The idea underneath this will to power as a principle is that they are wanting to develop, and we've mentioned this before, something like an ontological principle, in other words, a principle that is true of being, or in their phrase, true of becoming, rather than true of becoming for us. And this crucial difference is what distinguishes them from Kant and from the Kantian phenomenology, the Kantian and the phenomenologists. For the Kantians and the phenomenologists, meaning and knowledge of the world is only meaning and knowledge of the world for us. There is a limit to what we can know structured by the human. For Kant, this is the categories we have. For the phenomenologists, this is the sort of, brutally speaking, the meanings we use. So there are certain meanings we use for the phenomenologists or certain categories we use for the Kantians, which we, as it were, impose on the world. And we can't do anything other than impose upon the world these limits. And so we are, as it were, sort of never able to really get to the world itself, get to being or becoming itself. These thinkers want to argue that thought is capable of reaching becoming itself. Okay, that's the absolute crux of what they argue. And as such, that's their big distinction between the Kantians, the phenomenologists, and the post-structuralists like Deleuze and Klosowski, is that they don't think that there is a necessary limit to what we can think, whereas the others do. Okay, that necessary limit is neither given by categories or meanings or language. There is no necessary limit. Why might they think that? We go back to the argument between the difference between thought and expression. Is that if we are able to show the limits of expression in terms of the thought it is trying to express, we're not trying to express those limits, we're trying to show them. We're able to show those limits, we can go beyond the limits of expression. So just because we can't say it doesn't mean we can't whistle it. This is a phrase that goes all the way back to the Tractatus and a response to the Tractatus made by a person called Frank Ramsey. The Tractatus argued that if you can't say it, you can't say it, and you can't do anything else with it either. But you can show it. You can show, Wittgenstein thought in the Tractatus, the structures of logic, even though you can't say them. Ramsey's response was, if you can't say it, you can't say it, you can't whistle it either. So, you know, don't bother. But in the sense of the Tractatus and some of the stuff in here is relying upon an idea that you can somehow show certain problems, show certain thoughts, show certain positions. And the core for them is not because they want to get outside of thought or outside of logic or the limits of logic. What they want to do is they want to essentially have a notion of truth that is not centered on the human. That's why they refer to this non-anthropomorphic position. They do not want to take the human as the Archimedean point from which we know everything. Sometimes they were called for this reason anti-humanists, and they often sometimes made that explicit themselves, that they were anti-human. And they took that from Nietzsche, this sort of going beyond the human. They think the human is a limit only if we accept it as a limit. It's not an absolute limit. It's a limit that we are inside, but that we can find strategies to overcome. And constantly their thought is, and their ways of thinking are attempts to find strategies for overcoming the limits that we live in as human, whether they be limits of language or logic or categories. Or, you know, you can find limits in various other places. But that is going to rely upon a category that Kant expels very early in his work, and that's the category of intuition. To show something is not to be able to say it. In other words, to show something is not to be able to make it explicit knowledge, is to be able to make something intuitively aware, intuitively available. That doesn't mean, you know, simply opinion-based. We are trying to construct, as it were, intuitions that are common and general. In the same way that when someone tries to produce a piece of music that is happy or sad, It is not just happy or sad for them. If it were, it wouldn't be any bloody good. If it's any good, it will produce the happiness or the sadness in a range of people, but not everybody. Some people will still not respond in that way, but it will be able to sort of, as it were, generally appear happy or sad. You know, produce a sort of emotion. That's when it works. And the greater they can do that, the more widely they can do that, the more powerful the piece of music will be. So the ode to joy is not, you know, something you would generally go along and go up and listening to the ode to joy and feel like slitting their wrists. You know, people will be going, why do you feel like that? That's a really strange reaction. You know, you might go, oh, God, I hate it, it's fucking cheesy, or I don't like classical music generally, but you know, if you didn't have those responses, if you didn't respond to it with them, it's an uplifting piece, or it's, you know, maybe a culminate of joyful. So they're trying to use the notion of intuition, they're trying to show certain things. But it doesn't mean they're reducing it to opinion, and this is, as I say, an attempt to get beyond these limits that are imposed by other sort of philosophers. And that's why they're talking about this idea of cosmic subjectivity. So, in other words, for their ontology to work, it must be an ontology that makes sense when we talk about how the moon perceives things, or how the sun knows things. There must be a way in which we can also talk about that as well. Not just knowledge is purely a human thing, or perception is purely a human thing. Knowledge and perception is going to be something that occurs throughout becoming, which is where we really begin to enter some very strange sort of places. One final point before we move on to next week, when we're looking at chapter 3. Dominance does not equal successful or surviving. This is particularly developed later on in the chapter. Okay, a reactive force, they say, can prevail because it can survive, we might think. That's why it prevails. It can survive. It can control or organise. But one of the things they constantly come back to is this idea that the slave can prevail over the master without therefore stopping from being a slave. So survival, being able to prevail, being able to continue, it's got nothing to do with survival of the species or what's useful for the human or for you or what's good for society. Just because something has survived doesn't, in a sense, mean that it's dominant equaling active. It's, in a sense, dominant as slave as well. So that dominant, active, dominated, reactive distinction, that is, it's not a close and fixed match. If something is dominant, doesn't mean it's active. Dominant and dominated are quantity distinctions, which has got most force at the moment, which is in control. The one that's in control is the dominant. But then we assess whether it's active or reactive. So the crucial thing to remember is that quantity-quality distinction is usually inverted. That which we encounter as the dominant is usually that which is also reactive. Okay, so that which is encountered as a fact, as everyone said, well, they say at one point, is always the reactive, that which is encountered as in charge or the fact of the moment. So it's worth bearing those things in mind. Now they want to mix those two distinctions together. Okay, so the sort of facts of the matter, dominant will usually be reactive, but the forces underlying them, the dominant will be the active. So there's two different ways. The principles, that which may or produce the way things are, the fundamental principle will be the active or the dominant, but now it's, as it were, gone through the slave revolt. And they will constantly think of things in terms of the slave revolt. There's always going to have been this moment of the slave revolt that's occurred, whether it be in your thought or in the objects you encounter. There's always going to, in a sense, be this moment of the slave revolt, the moment of death. And it's worth bearing in mind that that goes radically against the common concepts of biology, which works with the notion of homeostasis. This is non-homeostatic. Homeostasis is the capacity for maintenance of continuity. Okay, so that which enables the species to continue is that which contributes to its homeostasis. This type of active force, the active force they are talking about, is a non- or anti-homeostatic force. So, of course, therefore, you can begin to extrapolate. The fact that something is continuing means that there's a sort of homeostatic force that's dominated, but homeostasis is precisely a result of a reactive force, a trying to hold things together force, rather than allowing things to go to their limits. So life itself will always, as it were, explode societies, groups, communities, species, etc. And it's the force that enables things to evolve in that sense. It's not the fact that we are able to adapt and become homeostatic that produces evolution. In other words, we'd never have changed. It's the mutation that produces evolution. That which is precisely the non-homeostatic, that which disrupts the species or disrupts the particular system, that's which is the active force. And it's that which is permanently removed, constantly striven to be denied, constantly being struck out of society or struck out of the species. And so it's worth bearing that in mind. Dominance does not equal successful surviving, almost the exact opposite. Homeostasis is, as it were, one of the ways in which the reactive is encountered as the everyday world around us. So chapter 3 next week, can you in particular, I want you to particularly look, I mean I want you to look at the whole thing, okay, but in particular I want you to look at this idea of, in sections 2 and 3, and then in 9, 8, 9, 10 and 11, okay? So in particular in 2 and 3, 8, 9, 10 and 11.